You're listening to Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family. Welcome to Sleep Stories for Equestrians. I'm your host, Ashley Winch. We're so happy you're here to relax and unwind. If you fall asleep and miss the story, we will recap it at the beginning of the next episode. We've also selected and edited these stories for ultimate relaxation, removing any stressful bits without affecting the story's integrity, so you can focus on drifting off to sleep. With that, let's settle down and prepare for our story. The gates are closed. The horses sleep. The day's work done. The chores complete. Now let us rest, our bodies and minds. Drift off to sleep and close your eyes. It's time for us to turn down for the night. Now let's breathe in, breathe out, and turn off the light. One more time, breathe out, breathe in. Now let us begin. On the last episode of Sleep Stories for Equestrians, we met Barney and Invictus. This time, we're meeting Tiny and Clasper. Tiny, as her name denotes, was a very small and bay like myself. She was quite the smallest pony I've ever seen. And as people made a good deal of fuss over her on this account, she liked being small and was very proud of herself and sometimes put on great airs before Eros, Chanticleer, and myself. Chanticleer and Eros were just amused at the silly little thing and laughed at her, but I didn't like it when she came up to me and tossing her proud head in the air would say, "Well, Elf, how many sweet things have you made Master carry back onto the house this week, only to take them a little later on from Evelyn?" Her impudence and rudeness made my blood boil, and I felt furious with her. The insinuation was so horrid and low down, and I am sure it all came out of her jealousy of me. She thought, as she was so small, that Master ought to love her best. And when she saw me refuse the good things Master used to bring me, before I made him understand that I didn't want them from him, and that I only wanted him to love and be loved by him, she called me stupid and silly, and said I was the most selfish not to think of her, and that if I didn't want the sweet things Master brought for me, I might at least take them and keep them for her, because I knew how much she loved sugar and nice things to eat. Of course, I did know this only too well, for the year before, poor Tiny had been very ill, so ill that she nearly died. It happened this way. Tiny had been to the big horse show in London, and her extreme smallness, as usual, gained for her a lot of attention. She was fed with sweets and cakes of every description, and petted and spoiled to her heart's content. I remember so well how cross and irritable she was when she came home from the show, and she was so rude to my mother, Lady Beechwood, that even Chanticleer was roused and gave her a good scolding. Tiny didn't care a bit, however, and when she saw Master petting me, she tried to draw his attention upon herself, but he only gave her one or two hatsy pats and left us. Tiny was furious, and she called Master an old silly and said, "Why didn't he bring me something nice to eat when I have been at the show all day? I wouldn't have bothered him to carry it back to the house." And she glared very meaningly at me. it was a very good thing Master didn't think of bringing anything for Tiny that evening, for the truth was she had really overeaten herself at the show, and I expect this was the reason for her extreme naughtiness. Ricketts had a good deal of trouble in getting her to bed, and during the night she became very ill indeed. I think she really must have been in terrible pain, for she groaned so loudly that it awoke both Eros and me, and we heard Ricketts go quickly to find her, to see what was the matter. For a long time, Tiny was very sick, and she became so weak and exhausted that Ricketts thought she would die, for I heard him tell Master so the next morning. Master was very much annoyed when he found out about the overfeeding, and said to Ricketts, "The next time Tiny goes to a show, please see that she has a big notice put over her box, asking the people to be kind enough to not give her any sweets or other things to eat." I should have almost died with shame had I been Tiny and been threatened with such a notice. But when she heard about it, she just laughed and said, "If Master thinks he will do me out of good things to eat in that way, he is jolly well mistaken, for lots of the children, and certainly those who give me the most to eat, were much too small to read any stupid notices." Eros and I both thought they would possibly have someone with them who could read, but we forbore to say so, as poor Tiny was still weak and limp from her recent illness. Sometimes I tried to talk to Tiny when she said nasty things about dear Master, but I never could get her to see how mean it was of her to fuss over him as she always did whenever she got the chance, and then to speak as she so often did behind his back. Perhaps it was because she was so very small and cannot quite understand like Eros and I do. When full grown, Tiny was scarcely bigger than Master's St. Bernard dog Nero, of whom you shall hear more later. Some time after Tiny had been made so ill at the horse show, Master sold her, and she went to a new home to become the pet and plaything of some of the very children who had given her so many good things to eat the preceding year. Fascinated by her size, these little people had given their father and mother no peace until Tiny became their very own property. Little Evelyn Ricketts was very sorry when Tiny went away, for Master had let her drive the miniature creature whenever she wished to do so. Harnessed to one of the smallest of speed wagons, into which Evelyn could just squeeze herself, she and her brother John, who makes such a brave-looking tiger in his very correct livery, spent many happy hours driving Tiny about. Clasper is a foxhound, and he and I always have been, and still are, great friends. Often after a good day's sport, he will creep into my stable in the evening and tell me about all the fun. He and Minnie like each other too, and she is always glad when Clasper comes and curls herself up against his back. Master uses Clasper for drag hunting, a very humane form of sport, for in it no living creature is chased and run to ground, but only the strong scent of a trail is followed. A piece of rag is dipped in aniseed, and a man, who is generally about an hour and a half start given to him, makes the trail by dragging the soaked piece of rag along the ground. When the half hour is up, the hounds are let loose, Clasper amongst them, and they, with Master and his friends on horseback, begin the hunt. Most of the hounds enjoy the sport thoroughly, but not so my friend Clasper, who, low be it spoken, is really a very lazy fellow indeed. Instead of giving all his attention to the trail, Master Clasper is invariably wondering how soon the motor car will appear in sight, which is always sent to some place on the route to take Master and his friends home again. By having the car fetch the humans, horses are relieved of their burdens and are allowed to return leisurely home. Directly, the lazy Clasper catches sight of the motor car. Any interest he has had in the hunt goes at once, and his one idea is to reach the car, jump into it, and there await Deer Master and his friends. When they arrive, he gives them such a nice welcome that they forget to reproach him for his laziness, and he manages to get a very fair amount of attention we all so dearly love for himself. We all try to get as much of Master for ourselves as we can, and I must confess that I am very lucky in that respect. When Clasper came to the stable to recount the doings of the day, he told me that one of his friends, called Damien, had once taken part in one of the most famous Grasmere hound trails. "Do tell me what he told you, Clasper," I said, and Clasper, nothing loath, for he was really very comfortable in the stable, and Minnie was keeping his back very warm, began. "Every year, in the month of August, when the beautiful little village of Grasmere is gay with visitors, one day is set apart for its world-famed sports, and the hound trail, together with the guide's race, are the two most important events of the day. For the former, a man goes off in the usual way, with a long rag soaked in aniseed, and all the hounds are held in leash in the ring until the man returns. Directly, they begin to smell the scent of the aniseed, and they get very excited, and are quite difficult to hold in until the man who has been making the trail returns to the ring. As soon as he reappears, the signal is given for the hounds to start, and Damien says it is considered a very pretty sight to see them go with great leaps and bounds, keenly following the trail. In the hilly country of Westmoreland, the maker of the trail gives a varied route, and the hounds in search for it rush up the grassy fells, and then down again on the vale beneath with lightning speed. Over high walls and low, they spring with perfect ease, and the one who first enters the ring wins the prize, amidst the cheering and clapping of a huge and enthusiastic crowd. Damien also told me, continued Clasper, that people come from near and far to see the pretty sight, attracted no doubt partly by the extreme beauty of the little village and its surroundings. The lake, with its lovely little island almost in the center, is the most beautiful and picturesque, and lies nestling amidst some of the finest and most varied of the wonderful Westmoreland hills. It is an ideal spot for the trail, and the hounds in their speedy flight after the scent they love to follow are often and again momentarily lost to sight, only to reappear again in a marvelous way and remind one of the very fells they traverse, whose lofty summits disappear from time to time into a veil of mist and suddenly reappear again, grander and, if possible, more beautiful than before. The vale in its gentler beauty is a veritable garden of the Lord, each man in the place of an under-gardener, keeping his own little corner bright and gay with those hardy annuals and brilliant rock flowers of the district, ever proud and anxious to preserve the unique loveliness of his own particular spot in the vast natural garden, spreading over the greater part of Westmoreland and Cumberland. The mountainous and gloriously wonderful scenery, gathered so closely together in that far-off corner in the northwest of England, is ever an eloquent, though silent, proof of the almighty power and superhuman skill of the master gardener. Clasper told me that his friend grew quite poetic in describing the great beauties of his former home, and I longed to make the acquaintance of Damien, little guessing then how I should do so, or how useful he was one day to me in giving me details of the marvelous endurance of many of the horses used for the coaches in the Hilly Lake District. Here, Clasper got up and gave himself a stretch, and Ricketts just then appearing at the stable door called him to go to his own apartment for the night. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Sleep Stories for Equestrians. Allow this gentle music to carry you off to dreamland.